in association with Newsarama. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress, a special two-parter today. Last month at the L.A. Central Public Library, five men from the comics industry presented a panel on the future of graphic literature. The panel was organized by writer Joshua Fialkoff, known best for his amazing story Elk's Run, which is now collected as a graphic novel from Villard Books. Ross Ritchie, the publisher behind Boom Studios, who has a shared history in comics going back to the 90s at Malibu and A-list Hollywood ties to guys like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mark Waid likely needs no introduction given his work as both an editor and writer at Marvel and DC on characters that range from Spider-Man to Superman. Christos Gage, best known for TV shows like Law & Order and comics like World War Hulk X-Men and World War Hulk Iron Man, and of course Wildstorm Stormwatch PhD. Kazu Kabuishi, the artist behind the successful anthology series from Image Comics called Flight, and Tony Fleece, the writer-artist behind the very funny indie comic In My Lifetime. What I like about this group is the fact that they represent a pretty good cross-section of comics, ranging from the so-called mainstream to the alternative small press. I want to thank Josh Fialkoff for allowing me to host the audio recording of the panel, which frankly features a very good discussion covering many topics that I think you've seen on websites and have probably had in comic stores yourselves. When the Q&A section starts up, I'll pop in every now and then to fill in for the audience. They weren't mic'd for the event. But enough of the setup. Let's go to the panel.
Hi, everybody. I'm Josh. I'm Josh Fialkoff. I'm a comic writer. I helped to put together this here little panel. Let me introduce the rest of the panelists to you. Yeah. Mr. Mark Waid, right here immediately to my left.
Oh, don't get up, please.
And then we have Mr. Ross Ritchie. Kazu Kibuishi. Is that good? Did I do okay?
Yeah, that's good.
Christos Gage and Mr. Tony Fleece. So I guess real quick, why don't we run down and kind of introduce ourselves and say what all we've done, Mark?
Oh, okay.
Two or three things, I think.
My name is Mark Waid. I've been writing comics for about 20 years. I've written everything from Superman to Archie comics and everything in between. And right now I'm the editor-in-chief of Boom Studios, one of the up-and-comer young publishers out here in Los Angeles.
I am the co-founder and CEO guy of Boom Studios, and we publish comic books.
I'm the editor of an anthology called Flight, and also I'm a graphic novelist. I do solo books. I did a book called Daisy Cutter for Viper Comics, and I have a new book coming out through Scholastic next year called Amulet. So.
I've written for many publishers, including Marvel and DC, things like World War Hulk, X-Men, and Stormwatch PhD for Wildstorm. And I've also written for movies and television, including Law & Order Special Victims Unit and other things like that.
I wrote an autobiographical comic book called In My Lifetime. It's all I've done. I don't have much more to contribute to this panel after that. So, Mr. Waid, if you need water after you're finished with that first one, I'll be the one running to get it.
And I'm Josh. I did a book called Elk's Run that was just put out by Random House. I also do an independent comic book called Punk's the Comic that came out from Digital Webbing a few months ago, and various other work-for-hiree type things. The reason that we're here today is, I don't know if you noticed, but comic books, they're not just for kids anymore. They say that in the newspapers all the time whenever they write about them. And I wanted to kind of, you know, when I talked to the library about putting together a panel, what I wanted to do was to do something where we could really talk about how the comics industry is actually changing to kind of meet the new market that's out there, from things like Mango, which are getting young adults to actually read books for the first time in many of their lives, to the more serious graphic novels coming out through book publishers. And it was really just kind of a chance to, I wanted to take a chance to get a wide swath of guys who work in the business and work in very different ways of doing it, very different aspects of the business, to sort of give us an overview of where things are. So kind of the first place I'd want to start is, I remember as a kid when I was reading comics, there was a couple kind of major difference. Number one, they were pretty much all superhero comics that's what I was aware of. And there wasn't really a lot of choice, and while you could get them at the newsstands, there was no kind of reliable means of distribution. There was all these problems. And we're starting to fix them. But there's still some challenges that are kind of in front of us. I want to kind of get the panel's feedback on you know, where we're trying to address that and how we're actually trying to get our books into people's hands.
All right, I'll start. Just because I can sense that nobody else wants to be the first to speak.
Thank you.
So, all right, so I'll make this as brief and painless as I possibly can. So in the 1930s, when comics were created, they were everywhere. You could find them at any newsstand. They were selling in the millions because all magazines were selling. And comics were a dime, and, you know, Time Magazine was a dime, and Newsweek was a dime. And so, you know, retailers across the nation made money indiscriminately, whether they were selling an issue of Superman Comics, whether they were selling an issue of Life Magazine. Over the years, as the 40s and 50s came along and prices started to escalate on magazines, this is a lot more interesting than it sounds, I promise. We'll get to the punchline in a minute. As magazine prices increased, 25, 35, 45 cents, dollar, retailers realized, well, why am I still carrying comics? Because comics were the only mass medium that decided we're not going to try to keep up with the price increases. We are a kids medium and we should be cheaply priced. And so instead, not following the lead of any other media, we will like chop the number of pages, we'll make the production values lower, and we'll just keep the price as low as we possibly can, which was great in the 40s and 50s, and it meant comics were still, you know, a viable kids medium. But the problem is, when you get in the 60s and 70s, and retailers realize I can devote that shelf space to a dollar issue of Sports Illustrated and make a lot more money, or I can, you know, 10 or 12 cent issue of Superman, I'm not going to make the same amount of money. Suddenly we just started disappearing from the newsstands. And that's why, to this day, you can't, you know, when was the last time any of you saw a comic book for sale any place, but maybe, I don't know if you've even been in any dedicated comic shops, but outside a comic shop, like, when was the last time anybody ever saw one?
Can I jump in here?
Yeah.
With as well, like, I think another problem with that is if you carry comics and you're carrying sort of the mainstream stuff in the 60s and the 70s, you're carrying Superman and Batman and Spider-Man and the Hulk and that full range of stuff, whereas with the Sports Illustrated analogy, you're only carrying one magazine.
Right.
You kind of can't only carry one comic book.
Right. So it's just – so what we managed to do was, you know, over the years, we managed to successfully transform comics from a mass medium into a niche market. Yay, us. But that goes to the issue of distribution. So the problem that we've run into in the last 20 years is we get hoisted by our own petard, and suddenly as comics – first off, catch up in terms of production value and catch up in terms of sophistication and become more adult-oriented and become for a broader range of audience rather than just children. That's great. Now we've got all this amazing material that cuts across a wide swath of demographics and is appealing to everybody. There's something in comics that everybody from your grandmother to your five-year-old cousin can latch onto. But we have no way of getting it to you. There's no workable distribution system, and that's what we're fighting against now. We're making headway, I would say, and I would like you to jump in and talk more about this because that's where you have a lot more of your finger on the pulse. But this is a fair assessment that we're fighting an uphill, that we're basically having to make up for a lot of lost time.
I think absolutely, and one of the innovations that I think a company like Tokyopop should get credit for was creating a comic book, in this case a manga, that had a certain size and a price point. At $9.99 at the digest size, that really worked with the mass market. And I think that's the trick for comic book graphic novel publishers. If you go to Borders and Barnes & Noble, it's exciting because they're carrying a lot more of that content and a lot more of that product. But you can see the wide range of sort of approaches from Dark Horse to Image to Marvel and DC and even Boom, and how everyone is trying to kind of figure out what the page count is. If you look at manga, it's much more uniform in how thick it is, what the value for the price point is. But I think it's something that we're figuring out right now, and it's exciting because the mass market is demonstrating that there's an audience that's there that's waiting to be tapped. And I think that the different outlets are figuring out the potential of the medium. What's cool is, you know, Josh organized this, and he's one of the few creators that's in the medium right now, Kazu obviously as well, that has signed with a mass market book publisher to do a graphic novel, which is a huge new trend. It happened intermittently, I think, over the past 40 years, maybe a handful of times, but now it's becoming much more the regular course of business.
Along those lines, Kazu, with Flight, you have a book that works for both of the things we just talked about. It's a book that is in bookstores and sells, I believe, predominantly through bookstores still.
Yeah.
That's also, going back to what you're talking about, at actually being a medium for kids, Flight, while not being aimed for children, is certainly young adult targeted. And it's something where you see kids see it and their eyes kind of light up. It's not, but it's also not manga. So it's something very different from them. And it's much has much more in common with American comics than it does with, say, Japanese or Asian comics in general.
I think the main problem has been that in the American market, we haven't been able to nail down a proper production model. Because in Japanese comics, I mean, when we get them here, the manga comes here in a collected form. This is after it's been produced. This is after the fact, like comic issues are compiled in a trade paperback, they're often called a graphic novel. So World War Hulk or whatnot will come in this book form, but you didn't, you know, if it's in the bookstore, you probably didn't see it coming out monthly as a monthly serialized magazine. Well, with the current model, basically that niche market is going to have to dump their money in and support that serialized comic in order for it to even make it to the bookstore. Well, I thought, well, why don't we bypass that completely? And if we, you know, just did it like the Japanese model, which is basically just put together an anthology of these single issue comics, and they all have a sort of similar aesthetic and feel, that people would consider it a graphic novel. And that's basically what we did with Flight, was that, you know, these people are serializing longer stories. In some cases, not. A lot of them are just standalone short stories. To basically serialize it so that the artists aren't taxed to death trying to complete a graphic novel. Right now, there's a lot of artists out there that are trying to fit that the graphic novel model by doing the entire book in one shot. And just this past couple of years, I worked on one for the very first time in my life. I did like a 200-page book. I pretty much did all of it, you know, all at once. And I know why you don't do that. You know, most people don't have the kind of obsessive drive that I probably did to try to finish it.
Also, it's a matter of production realities. I mean, what we do in the States is the default model is that we produce things as like shorter installments, you know, like a monthly comic book that will come out every 4 or 5 weeks, and it'll be another chapter in the ongoing story, and then we'll take a bunch of those and package them together as a graphic novel. Because the economic reality is, if you're a publisher, you can afford to pay advances to an artist or a writer for that short installment because the money's not that huge. If you're a publisher and you're asking somebody to commit to a 250-page graphic novel that's going to take a year of their life, that you don't have enough money to put up to advance them a living wage, and they don't have the wherewithal to go a year without a paycheck. So it's a much more economically friendly model. But, I don't know. I had nothing to follow that up with.
Why don't Ross and I have talked about in the past the idea that the monthly comic has become kind of like a marketing expense. Like it's something that you do not necessarily because that's the ultimate format, but it's become – this is the means to an end, the end being the graphic novel and being able to put it on your bookshelf. And I can
elaborate on that, but
that I think, you know, as Kazu's talking about, you know, there's from a publishing perspective, and I think I'm the only person here that, you know, is not a creative type who just comes from it from the business perspective. I know that I find it as a tool is very useful to help creators. If you serialize as a monthly comic, what you're doing is you're piecing the work out in sort of these nice small increments. And I think a lot of freelancers can really appreciate it. It's more satisfying to be able to get 15, 20, 22 pages done in a chunk and feel like you accomplished something, send your invoice in, get paid. But I think what you're talking about is we're also kind of in a different environment right now, which is a lot of product is being published. There's a real explosion going on in creativity. And as a result, I think on the fan level, it's difficult to keep up with everything that's going on. And so if there's a book, let's say it's an Elk's Run that gets serialized in a monthly format, then people are talking about it on the net. The bloggers are checking it out. The reviewers on the websites are looking at issues 3, 4, and 5. And everybody can kind of buzz about it. And people who are sort of late coming to the party can find out about it, and then hopefully hit that crest and that wave when it comes out in a trade paperback format where they miss the first couple of issues. Maybe they're sold out at their local retailer, and they can pick up the trade. So it definitely has, I think, from a publishing perspective, an advantage in the marketing as well as sort of just the overall business structure, organizational structure of helping a creative team be able to, you know, pull together and create it.
Do you find, I was going to actually ask Chris, as somebody who's doing some pretty high-profile freelance superhero writing right now, do you find what Ross is saying to be true? Like, does it actually help, or are you still, do you look at it as being, I'm writing for the trade paperback, I'm trying to get to that end goal?
No, I mean, well, some of the stuff I'm doing, you were right about getting too close to, yeah.
Back it up.
I mean, the stuff I'm, you know, I've done higher profile stuff like World War Hulk, X-Men, which is part of a big Marvel Comics event, and that one you're definitely doing for the monthly because, you know, people are eagerly awaiting it every month, and they're going to be there and buying it, and you know, they're going to be at the store every Wednesday for the latest chapter in World War Hulk, which is basically the Hulk fighting everybody.
Yay.
It was awesome. You know, on the flip side, my wife Ruth and I, you know, have just made a deal with Oni Press to do an original graphic novel, which will be, we're writing it and it'll be drawn. It'll come out directly as a 132-page graphic novel. So I may have the page count wrong, but, you know, so I've taken both approaches, and I think it depends on what works best for what you're doing. And to me, that, as a creator, that's actually one of the good things about what's going on right now. If you can sort of come up with an idea or a story and say, okay, what works best for this? You know, what's the best way to do this? Is it something that, you know, I can sell to a publisher as a monthly? Is it something people will want to pick up every month? Or is it the kind of thing that I might want to sit down and, you know, write out as a self-contained story, as a book, and try to sell as a book? Taking that a bit further, it's almost like now the barriers have broken down between media. You can almost come up with an idea and say, okay, is this a comic book? Is this a TV show? Is this a movie? Do I want to write it as a comic book, a screenplay? You know, what do I want to do? And that, I think, speaks to what you're saying about respectability of comics as an art form. And I know that in the past, like, there was a writer named Jerry Conway who wrote Spider-Man and other comics for Marvel in the 70s. In the 80s, he started writing for television. And he had to hide the fact that he had been a comic book writer because it would have ruined his career. Now, someone like Brian Vaughn, who writes a fantastic comic called Why the Last Man, among others, was approached by the TV show Lost to come on their writing staff because they had seen and liked his comic book work. And it's not just with comics. I remember when I was in film school 10 years ago, if you worked in film, you didn't work in television unless you couldn't get work in film anymore. It was a step down. If you worked in live-action TV, you didn't work in animation. It was a step down. It meant you couldn't get work in live-action anymore. Now it's sort of fluid. People like Joss Whedon do film, TV. So from a creative standpoint, which is how I've approached it, that's one of the exciting things now is that things are very fluid, and it's almost like whatever's best for the material is an option to you. The market realities I can't really speak to, but from a creative standpoint, it's very exciting.
So we've talked a lot about, like, what's best, what works best for the creators, but I think the problem has, like, I think the model, the current model, the American model, it works fairly well for the creators, but it's not working really very well for new readers. There's just no access point, and that, I think, was the problem, or has been for the last, you know, however many years. So that's why the graphic novel is, like, this new big thing, because people, they want to read comics, but they just don't know where to come in. And the graphic novel is what's giving them that access point. Maybe because I'm so new to this industry, I just came in with Flight. It was like the first thing, and I didn't even think I was going to be in the comics industry. I thought I was going to be working in film, actually. But I knew that, you know, well, for one, I wasn't going to be able to produce a graphic novel at that time. When I was putting together Flight, I wasn't going to be able to produce it myself. It would take me forever. Trying to do it in my free time, it would have been impossible. And I knew that was the case with all my friends that were working in animation or, you know, doing their web comics or whatnot. They just couldn't put that kind of investment in doing their own, putting their vision out there. Maybe they're just too humble to do it, you know. So that's why I decided to get all those people together and put it in this form that kind of looks like a graphic novel. The funny thing is that people consider Flight a graphic novel, and it's not.
Yeah, it's a collection of short stories.
So yeah, it's a collection of short stories, but people still say, oh, you know, it's like on all these top 10 graphic novel lists, you know, for the year. And people, for some reason, when it comes to comics, they don't make that, you know, they don't disassociate the short format with the long format.
Right.
Well, that's
it's really interesting, as long as it's collected.
Another kind of interesting thing, having dealt with book publishers and going into libraries and every Barnes & Noble and Borders that I can, what's always kind of just baffled me is that there is just a section that is comics or graphic novels, and there's actually a separate manga section. The manga does get its own section, but the graphic novels are just kind of thrown in, and I think the label graphic novel gets applied to just kind of everything, despite the fact that we're all working in pretty different genres, everything from historical fiction to action adventure to, you know, romance. I mean, there's all these different genres, but we get kind of lumped in as though we are just one thing. So I know from dealing with my publisher at Random House, with my editor at Random House, that's one of the big initiatives, is actually getting graphic novels shelved with their genres instead of being shelved by their format. Essentially, what do you guys think about that stuff?
Well, I think graphic novels should be shelved on their own. I do, but the problem is that we don't have enough. That's all. I think if we had more content, we would be in a better position. If we just shuffle the books in with the other books out there, I really think there's going to be a lot of people who will be turned off by that when they're looking for a prose novel and they find this graphic novel sitting there with the same. Maybe about 25-30% will look at it and go, oh, a comic book. I haven't read this in a long time. But the majority will be looking for a certain type of thing, which is a prose novel. And when they see a comic book, they'll be like, oh, this is misplaced. I really think they would see it that way. Unfortunately.
I was going to say, I would think that one exception might be when you have, you know, well-known novelists writing comic books, and then you see the publishers putting out their stories collected specifically to be,
yeah, that might be.
Shelved, yeah. with the books. And, you know, it's shocking to me to see the author's name bigger than the name, you know, bigger than Wonder Woman. You know, Jodi Picoult, yeah. Name is bigger than the word Wonder Woman. And I'm like, whoa, that's new, you know. But that's what's going to bring in the readers of her novels. And hopefully, you know, they pick it up, enjoy it, and then maybe they go over to the graphic novel section. And I agree with you, there probably isn't enough out there right now for them to be broken out, because then they might get lost.
It's just unfortunate that this medium would have to piggyback another one. And if we continue to do that, then that'll just be common practice. And
well, let me ask you. I'm curious because you're as you said, your book is an anthology, and you know, 100 years ago, a Charles Dickens book, you know, was written as a serial and serialized in, you know, whatever, a newspaper, or you know, stories were serialized in Saturday Evening Post or whatever.
Most novels that we read today were actually serialized.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, do you see a future for comic books, you know, like a mass market? Do you think the market would accept a, you know, graphic illustrated monthly, which had different types of stories in, or do you think there would be some resistance to that? Because I know Flight has a common theme, but it can vary widely in terms of what the story is.
Yeah, when I put together Flight, I mean, the goal was to try to get it done monthly. We've taken our first next big step, which is to do a version for that was completely appropriate for the youngest kids, and it's called Flight Explorer, that comes out the beginning of next year. So we'll have two Flight books now. So it's kind of biannual now. It's just been hard to get the art. Like I said, on the production side of it, it's hard for people to find the time to do something like this for a lot less money than they would make somewhere else.
Yeah.
So it's just going to take some time. But yeah, I do believe if the content is there, if it's good, they'll buy it. Mm-hmm. You know. But right now, it's just not, and there's not enough of it. And we're really just trying to we're just scraping the rinds of the melon at the moment to try to get it going. We just need to start growing more of these melons.
Well, Tony, what was your experience? Now what made you choose this medium to tell your story, and did you in fact invest like a year and a half of sweat equity hoping that there would be a payout at the end or whatever, or what?
I never really expected that there would be a payout. Yeah. When you decided to write a comic book about yourself, it's pretty, like, I don't know, it's not a comic book about how awesome I am, so I didn't expect that it would be, that people would be running out of the stores to buy it, but it was certainly, I haven't had experience with the bookstore market, but as far as comic stores, it was certainly a challenge to break through First of all, most comic stores, because I called most comic stores on the phone, most of them are pretty much just interested in the big two companies, and because that's what sells for them. Makes sense. And so it's a lot of explaining why I'm going to introduce autobiographical comics to, you know, the Midwest. But the taking a chance on a new idea was a struggle to get that to happen in a lot of stores. But I think what I've seen is that just in comic stores, it has a lot to do with the people working behind, you know, it has everything to do with the people working at the comic stores. And in bookstores, I don't think they have necessarily, they don't have a graphic novel person. And that's why the graphic novel section looks like it does. It doesn't look like it looks at Meltdown. And I think what you were saying about getting them shelved in everywhere else makes sense to the fan of a crime novel is going to like to pick up Criminal. But there's not this, you don't get the person that just wants to buy a comic book no matter what and is going to stand there in the graphic novel section until something hits them.
Well, I think one of the things Tony was touching on too, which is part of what drew me to comics, and I think a lot of people, why they get into comics in the first place, is despite that it's kind of still a smaller mass medium, it's still a mass medium. And as a creator, it's a way for you to create something and actually distribute it to the world, or North America,
really,
depending on.
Dude, it's really not.
Really,
it's
like
a way to distribute
places.
It to 5,000 guys who live in their mother's basements. Is one
of those 5,000 guys are not all in your city. That's the nice
part. Sure.
But it's there's something
about me?
There's something about making a comic that you feel, especially versus, and I'm sure Chris can kind of talk to this, versus working in TV or working in film and the kind of fight to actually have a, you know, have a voice that gets through. Whereas in comics, even in my experience working with the bigger companies, and I'm sure you guys can feed in more, even working with these big icons, you still have a voice and you still get to kind of artistically speak.
I would go so far as to even say, even at a Marvel and DC level, there's a quality to comics where they're homemade that I think is very distinct from film and television and even novels.
I would definitely agree with that. And, you know, there's a comic book writer called Brian Bendis, who is one of the top writers at Marvel, or in the industry, but at Marvel. And he was invited to work on the Spider-Man animated show. And he was experiencing a great deal of frustration because only about 40% of what he wrote as a script would end up on the screen. It would get rewritten by executives and various people, and then budgetary needs would come in. And he was complaining to an executive, you know, only 40% of what I'm writing is actually making it onto the screen. And the guy said to him, hey, out here, that's considered a pretty good percentage. And he said, okay, I'm going back to comics. And he did. And it's really great because it's still a collaborative medium. So you're not alone writing a 500-page novel that you then send to a publisher and get a rejection letter back. You're working with other people and you're having that great creative synergy when you and your editor and your artist are really clicking. But at the same time, there's few enough of you that your vision and the artist's vision and the editor's vision is all coming together and coming through. I mean, I get to write my own ad copy if I want to for Marvel and DC books. You know, and if they're going to make a change, most of the time, unless there's some pressing reason, they ask you about it. You know, they run it by you. So it's you're getting your work across in a much purer form. Whereas in movies, you may be rewritten by six other writers who may or may not get credit with you. And then if they don't and you hate what they did, it's up there with your name on it, you know. So, I mean, that is a strong appeal to comics for – you see a lot of Hollywood, quote-unquote Hollywood writers writing comics. That's one of the main appeals is your vision comes through in pure form. Another one, of course, is that you don't have to worry about budget. You can – anything you can imagine can be done.
And Ross, you've one of the strong suit of Boom has been your ability to create great comics that translate into films, and you've gotten a ton of attention from Hollywood. Want to kind of talk about your experiences in the Hollywood trenches?
Well, I think Boom's a little distinct from a lot of other companies because the guy that co-founded the company with me, Andrew Cosby. He and I, we originally worked for Malibu Comics in the early 90s, and we were sort of, what I always like to say is we were comic book guys before we were Hollywood guys, but to the comic book guys, it's like we were comic books, then Hollywood, and then comic books, and then Hollywood, It all sort of blends together. We had some experience as producers selling projects to the studios before creating the company. But, you know, Hollywood's a funny thing, and I think that what everyone reacts to is having a clear vision and having a real passion for what you're doing. And you can't ever decide, oh, well, you know, I've got this great idea, or I just heard this really cool concept and I think it's going to be a movie. What you need to do is you need to create a really great comic book series or a really great graphic novel. And I think people respond to that. And they sometimes respond to that as a, you know, they want to do an internet series or they want to do a video game or a TV show or a film or whatever. And all those things at Boom, we sort of look at as they come case by case, knowing that, you know, our objective is to build a great catalog of material that'll be around for the next 20 to 50 years. And those are things that we can do or we cannot do them, because ultimately we're creating, you know, graphic novels that will be in our catalog for the rest of the company's existence. Does that make any sense?
Yes. Yes, it did. Tony?
I had my second thing to say. I think that the I think that the singularity of it is appealing not only to creators but also sort of to the audience, because there's certain people that like that are into independent film, because you sort of get to see a creator's voice come through directly and that sort of thing. Like if you go see like a Harmony Korine picture or like a Gus Van Sant picture, you know what you're getting into. And that kind of thing happens in comics, but on like the hugest books. So like if you go pick up Civil War, you know that you're going to get a Mark Miller comic, and you know sort of what the, like how the dialogue goes, and you have patterns that you pick up on, things that you respect and that you respond to in an artist's work. And that's sort of true of every comic. Like if you find one creator that you attach yourself to in comics, then you can sort of follow that through. And it's like, so it's like film, but you don't have to wait, you know, 4 years for the next Woody Allen movie.
I think what you're talking about, I think what you're saying is one of the things that comics does really well is voice. And I think that it is, as a per capita, per sort of a ratio of comics in comparison to other mass mediums, I think probably book publishing is the only other thing that maybe rivals it or surpasses it for voice. So I think voice, you know, totally pushes books, but it's much more common to see, even in the big superhero comics, an auteur's voice on the page than it is to see that in, you know, the Transformers or whatever the big Hollywood movie is.
Yeah, I think Tony makes a really good point, for instance, which is that even on the big icons, if you've got Ed Brubaker writing Daredevil, you're going to get Ed Brubaker's version of Daredevil. Whereas if you go to work on a show that's been around for, you know, if you go to work on ER, your job is not to sound like you. It's to sound like the characters and the voice that the show has had established for the 10 years it's existed before you came there. So whereas in comics, people aren't going to say, wait a second, you know, Ed Brubaker's first issue, Daredevil's not talking the same way he was when Brian Bendis was writing it. They're looking for that. So I think that is an interesting point and one of the fun things about comics.
To cycle back around to what you're talking about with the Hollywood stuff, we had really kind of a funny situation with a comic book we published. It was a 3-issue miniseries called The Savage Brothers, which in essence I'm sum up for you as they're zombie hunters. Kind of simple. And so we had a video game company approach us, and they had just lost the license to a movie that was a zombie movie, and they had a video game that was basically that you're just shooting zombies. That's all you're doing is you're just killing zombies left, right, and center. And they said, we want to license your comic book. This is before Savage Brothers was even published. We want to license your comic book and make our video game after it. And here, the video game was actually done, and I like went to their office and sat down and played the video game. I'm like, okay, whatever. In between the time that the Savage Brothers was being worked on and came out, that company went out of business. We had another company come to us and say, we're making a zombie video game, and we want to license the Savage Brothers, and we want to make it a Savage Brothers video game. I'm like, okay. So I played that game too, and it looked cool, and it was really fun, and then they went out of business. So we published the first issue of the Savage Brothers, and I'm sitting in my office, and my phone rings, and my agent calls up, and he says, I just read this comic book, The Savage Brothers, that you guys put out, and this is just incredible. I love this comic book. And it's cool because, you know, you don't get that phone call every day. I'm like, wow, that's awesome. And he's like, yeah, I'm totally going to sell this as a film. And I was like,
Really? Okay. And then the phone started to ring off the hook, and everybody started to go, wow, this is the Savage Brothers. This is incredible. This is a movie. This is a movie. This is a movie. And then somehow the tide changed, and it turned into, wow, this would make a great TV show. So it's like, to the right, to the right, to the right, to the left, to the left, to the left. And so suddenly we started to take meetings to turn it into a television show. The interest in that sort of died down, and then it turned around, and now it's coming back around now, and everybody's persuaded that it's a feature film. And I think it is really awesome and exciting to get people interested in something like the Savage Brothers. It's a lot of fun because I think for however it works, what's happening is they're reading the book, they're getting excited about it, they love the voice, they like the characters, and they like the concept, and they're getting invested personally in you know, even as they're doing business in the story. But I think ultimately all of the excitement and interest that's occurring in features and TV and in video games and comic books, I think ultimately what we have to do as comic book people is sort of hew to let's do what we do. And I think that's what's attracted everyone to comics is the voice, the world, what we're doing, and that excitement. And instead of sort of, you know, deciding overnight that, you know, movies are bigger than us or TV's bigger than us, and let's change what we do and sort of come over to their side. What I always like to say is Hollywood is a lot like a cat. If you go into the living room and you try to go pet a cat, it runs away from you. But if you go in and you sit down on the couch and you start to watch TV, pretty soon the cat's in your lap and, you know, wants to, like, curl up in your lap. And that's generally been my approach with the stuff that we've done at Boom. It's just kind of let it be, let it do its own thing, and it'll all work itself out.
What do you think, kind of to turn the Hollywood question around, with all these gigantic, expensive blockbusters that are making more money than movies have ever made before, we aren't, as far as I know from looking at numbers and stuff, we aren't actually seeing the boom you would expect. Not that boom, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The sales boom that we would expect.
Yeah.
Why do you guys think that is, and what can we do about it?
That's distribution. Again, if, you know, there's no, if I go see, you know, the Spider-Man movie at the Arclight, I can't, there's no place within 5 miles that I can find a Spider-Man comic book. It's not like you can walk it, you know, to the newsstand across the street and go, oh, look, I want more of that. So I think that's an enormous part of it.
Well, and I think it's a complicated answer, and I think the first X-Men movie was like a great case exhibit A of that situation. I went and saw the X-Men with a really good friend of mine, and as we were walking back, he had read Spider-Man comics when he was a kid, very, very casually. And when we were walking back, he said, you know, that movie was awesome, and I really like those characters, and I know that's, you know, this is, X-Men's always been my favorite series. He was like, what can you give me that I can read that would be really great? And this is even before I think Marvel really had dedicated itself to its trade paperback program. And I gave him a sort of a selection of some of the more recent X-Men series at the time that were sort of starting their story arcs. He took them home and he just found it completely impenetrable.
Yeah.
And was totally turned off by it and never read another comic book again. In between the time of that and now, there has been a much more concentrated effort to get things in graphic novels and Borders and Barnes & Noble. And what we actually are seeing is that some of these big superhero movies are impacting Marvel and DC's sales on their graphic novel level. We're also seeing things like, you know, like one of the big events that I think has happened that doesn't get enough credit is the Halo graphic novel that came out sold somewhere around 150,000 copies in hardcover. Which is incredible. I mean, would be incredible for a major book lit publishing house, and was carried in GameSpot. But I think really what we're talking about is the distribution and the access. And I think moving past distribution and access, and let's say you can get your material into GameSpot and it's video game oriented and those sorts of things, I think the bigger question is, what's the brand recognition? Obviously, Halo can overcome that. It has a huge audience, you know. It's calculated at 13 million people that are familiar and follow the series, these big feature films that come out. When we talk about the authors that have their big name on the spine, they've obviously built up a fan base, so whatever they write, they're going to bring their audience to. Whereas when we're creating new series, which is, I think, something that we're really doing at Boom, and, you know, Tony, you're talking about, and, you know, the people on this panel have all sort of been known for creating new material, that's a whole different kind of challenge, which is how do you build either your brand, if you're an individual creator, as a creator, or how do you build your original concept or idea into something that has sort of brand name recognition?
Well, I think that if you look at, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Watchmen and V for Vendetta both did big spikes.
I was going to say, that's fair to say. When I was speaking more about the monthly, you know, the regular, you know, what we call comic books. But in terms of graphic novels, no, V for Vendetta, the trade paperback went through the roof.
And 300.
And Sin City to some degree.
But Mark, you make a valid point, which is that if a million people are willing, and it's a lot more than that, but let's say if a million people are willing to go see a Spider-Man movie, surely one-tenth of those people would be interested in a Spider-Man comic. But I think you're right. It's hard for them to know, okay, well, where do I start?
Yeah.
It's like me with Battlestar Galactica. I know at some point I've heard it's great. I should start watching it.
Right.
But I've missed two or three seasons.
Right.
And, you know, I have to wait until I get mono and I'm sitting at home, you know, unable to do anything and get the DVDs. But at least the DVDs are out there. It used to be that if you heard about, as you said, with the X-Men, there was nothing you could do. Now you can get the essentials, which are essentially like a phone book, you know, cheap paper, black and white. But it's like every X-Men comic ever made, you know, and it's like $12 for 500 pages and you get the first 5 years, you know, and then the second 5 years. So at least you can get those now. And I think the libraries have been very helpful too, with, you know, letting people know that those are out there and being a place where people can go and check something out. Because that's another thing is people don't really know, as you said, you can't just walk across the street and find something and flip through it and see what's to your taste.
Yeah,
you know?
And even if you could, you're going to get over there and you're going to find out that it costs almost as much as your movie ticket did.
Yeah.
So you're taking a real roll of the dice. It's not, comics are not cheap form entertainment anymore. They're like $3.99, $4.99.
Right.
You know, and that's a big chunk of change to take a roll of dice on something that you're not sure you would be interested in at all. So,
and also on the library front, you can always, don't forget, if there is a comic book that you want that you don't necessarily want to buy, you can go to your local library and they'll actually order it for you. So, like, you can really, there are ways to do it. I just think they're kind of hidden from people, and people don't necessarily think that, oh no, you know, you actually can.
Yeah.
Actually can find them. And that, again, to go back to my putting comics like more out there instead of kind of huddling them in the corner behind the D&D manuals.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's one of the things about it, is that idea of like, well, no, these books are there. Yeah. They're actually there and you can actually get them. But, and I know, again, with going to a Barnes & Noble, I think Tony was saying, you know, they don't have a graphic novel guy. And you can tell when they do, because then you can actually find stuff. But for the most part, it's a mess and I go and start straightening up because it drives me crazy.
Represent.
I was so happy. I went to the Borders in Century City, and as I was walking out, there was a guy that was like rifling through everything, and I basically figured out that he was an employee that was making the section straight.
Yeah, that's
the
cool.
Best.
Like that. Actually, that was me.
So. Is there any questions? Anybody have anything for us?
Yes, thank God. I mean, really, yeah.
Sir.
The first audience question asked where the panel felt the role of the direct market comic shop will be now that bookstores are carrying more comic trades and collections. Would the direct market survive?
I think that I'm definitely with Brian Hibbs, who runs Comics Experience in San Francisco and is a really outspoken retailer, who says that the more specialized product that you have, the more you need a specialized retailer. And I think the world of comics right now is a very specialized, knowledge-intensive medium. So I think what comic book shops are having to sort of deal with and figure out is something's happening now with graphic novels and trade paperback collections, where sort of the collected great masterworks of comics, and sometimes far beyond the masterworks, are catalog library items and are expected to be carried in all stores. And so, you know, companies like Marvel and DC, who have a huge trove of material, are putting their 1960s and 1950s and 1940s library into print. And there's kind of a tacit expectation from a really good comic book shop that you can roll in and buy the first archival material for the Doom Patrol, as well as Captain America and the X-Men. And I could say from a retail perspective, that's a huge challenge. I mean, really what's happening is they're going to have to make room in their shop and redesign the floor plan. And every month that goes by, more and more of this material is going to be in print. And it's going to chew through more space. Now, the flip side is, I think that what's going to happen is there's going to be an ability to track and manage. There's some changes that are happening through Diamond, which is the distributor for the comic book specialty market, to be able to track and inventory that kind of material. And I think all those changes are for good. And I believe that the retailers are going to adjust well, and I think that they're going to improve their stores to be able to handle the challenge. But I think that they deserve a tremendous amount of credit for how challenging it is. There's definitely not anything apples to apples that you can look at in retail, any other store that you can walk in that is facing such a seismic change with absolutely no roadmap of how to fix it.
And I think it's real clear when you go into shops. I mean, we're real lucky in Los Angeles because there's more amazing shops here than there are for, you know, every 10 states in the Midwest.
Oh, I mean, literally in Mississippi, I'm not kidding. In Mississippi, there's one comic shop. Yeah. In Alabama, there's two. I mean, in the entire state. So that you can't go ahead.
But you see, you know, out here, we really are kind of seeing the cream of the crop. These guys, because the market is so fierce, not just competing with Barnes & Noble, but competing with each other. I mean, how many shops are there that there's a shop less than two blocks away?
Yeah.
But you see these guys, and then you start seeing across the country with, you know, like the Isotope in San Francisco is another one, or there's lots of guys in New York City, which I guess these are all major cities, so it doesn't really count. But you see the guys who know what they're doing, and you see the guys who have that vision for evolving. And I think at the end of the day, those are the shops that are going to survive, and those are the shops that are going to still be there, whereas the traditional vision of what a comic shop is, the Simpsons comic book guy, those shops are actually, I think, you know, fewer and far between as we go on.
Yeah, I grew up in central Massachusetts, a working class, Worcester, Massachusetts, you know, not a small city, but, you know, a working class place, not, you know, there are a lot of college students, but, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, there were a number of stores, and a lot of them were the comic book guy stereotype, and then there was one that was more professional, and that's the one that's still around. And one of the things that they've done, too, is they don't just sell comics. I don't see a lot of comic book stores anymore that just sell comics. They sell, whether it be, you know, role-playing games or video games or whatever, but they tend to be more diverse. And as you said, Ross, they specialize, they have specialized knowledge. You know, if you go in and you ask a question about, you know, an anime film, they're going to know the answer and be able to help you, whereas that's not the case at necessarily a mass, you know, a big bookstore.
I think like a comic shop is a lot more apt to put up a new shelf. You know, like Borders, every time I go into Borders, I expect they're going to have bought a new shelf for graphic novels because I've had to buy several, you know, in the time since Borders started having graphic novels. And comic stores are always reorganizing and, you know, you'll find a new nook or a cranny to shove, you know, 10 graphic novels in. So you sort of figure out once you've been into a comic store that, like, that's the place where they're going to have it. So if you go to Borders and you find, you know, like Frank Miller Daredevil Visionaries Volume 2, and you're like, that was terrific, I'd like to find Volume 1, you can go back and it's not necessarily going to be there, but odds are you walk into any comic store and it's going to be there.
Tony, you should tell your story about the comic shop when you were a little kid and the guy at the sunglasses place. It's a great story. I'm sorry, this is an aside.
This is something about the future of the graphic medium that I think you'll all enjoy. In the early 1990s in Colorado Springs, there's a comic book store called Heroes and Dragons. And they were right across the hall from a sunglasses store that really jumped onto the Oakley Revolution. I don't know if you guys remember the Oakleys. And that guy got real bitter real fast because, no, like, when you buy a $100 pair of sunglasses, you're not going back next week to buy another one. And so he pretty much just stood in the doorway and, where's the kids at? We're good. He would just lean up against the doorway, and when I would be like 14 years old walking out of the comic store with like New Mutants, he would sit there and go, fucking comics, fucking baby. And he'd go home, read your comic books. Every week, every Wednesday. There's the kids. Hello, kids.
Oh, goodness.
Thank you. So every week I'd have to walk past this guy on the way in and then shamefully walk past him on the way out. I bought my comics because he was angry at the specialty store where people knew they could go in and get their comics every week.
And thankfully that's what it all kind of comes down to for me, is that stigma is, I think, pretty much gone. Like, I don't – when I tell people I write – when I'm a comic book writer, after I explain that I'm not – I don't write stand-up, because when I say I write comics, they all assume once they understand that I write comic books, I don't get the same kind of dirty looks that you used to get, you know, even 5 or 6 years ago.
I mean, it's not completely fair litmus test because we're here. I mean, if we're not living in East Jesus, Iowa, where it would be a lot more difficult, I think, to explain what it is we do. But I think by and large, I think that's true.
Well, and I think that the term graphic novel that Eisner coined in the 70s was really useful for helping to differentiate what we do. I remember when I worked at Malibu Comics in the early 90s, they made these letter jackets for some of the staff members, and my boss, Tom Mason, used to like go to a restaurant and it said Malibu Comics Entertainment, and people would like really want to try to talk to him about representing them as a stand-up. And so, you know, the term comics and comic book, and I think the way that comic book has been used as a pejorative in, you know, movie reviews and how people describe things, I used to be very skeptical of, oh, it's a graphic novel. No, it's a comic book. But I have also seen with, you know, just some rank and file civilian people that would never in a million years look at or read a comic book are really excited to look at a graphic novel. And so if the term does that and wins new readers, then fantastic.
That seemed like a logical place to pause for part one. Part two is coming up post-haste, so be sure to stick around for it. Lots more interesting conversation as more discussion goes on to digital comics and why is the mainstream really superheroes, and why is it the real mainstream that everyone else enjoys that isn't a comic book fan more involved in the world of comics? Very interesting discussions from the panel coming up in part two. You'll want to check it out. Until then, this will wrap up this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, you can find Word Balloon everywhere. We're at Newsarama, at iTunes, Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, MySpace.com/WordBalloon, ComicSpace.com/WordBalloon. If you have any email feedback, I'm always available, john@wordballoon.com. And more great stuff coming up, more interviews as well, but part two is the next episode, so make sure you check it out. Until then, thanks a lot. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2007, all rights reserved, but this is Fialkov's show, so really this is Josh's property. We're just holding it for him.